is the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream. Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the history and culture of Iran, the continued protests and general strikes still rocking France since late last year, and for our weekly Earth Watch, why protecting forests are vital to saving the environment. Our guests are Dr. Azal Rad, a research fellow with the National Iranian American Council, Benoit Martin, who is jointly based in France and the UK, who writes about and monitors grassroots movements in France, including the recent strikes, as well as the Yellow Vest Movement, and Adam Collette, program director of the Dogwood Alliance, which mobilizes diverse voices to protect U.S. southern forests and communities from destructive industrial logging. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And today we are going to go directly to our weekly Earth Watch. We partner with the Global Justice Ecology Project for our weekly Earth Watch, and I need to know if our clips are ready. Okay. What we are going to do now is take a look at what is happening within our environment. The Trump administration is continuing to roll back protections for the environment, even as scientists and environmentalists warn that our planet will soon be at a breaking point if drastic change is not made. Even at the recent UN conference on the environment, COP25, little progress was made in the commitment of Western governments, in particular, the world's largest polluters, along with China and India, to protect the environment. And meanwhile, the forest in Australia that has devastated huge swaths of that country should be a warning sign to its climate-denying conservative prime minister. And in the United States, Trump's latest move, according to the Washington Post, is to exempt projects without significant federal funding from environmental reviews, which were required of them for the previous 50 years. This would make it easier to build mines, lay pipelines, and more. While we do see a growing environmental movement led by young people, including children, policymakers, for the most part, in the global north, are turning a blind eye. A hopeful proposal coming out of Europe is for a Green New Deal much more expansive than the one put forward by liberals in the U.S. Congress. Among other things, the Green New Deal for Europe calls for a care income for those caring for children, the elderly, those with disabilities, and the environment. It's a fusion approach to benefit people and the environment. We also see continued activism with frontline communities taking the lead, including indigenous people, and also by organizations like the World Forest Movement, the Dogwood Alliance, the Global Justice Ecology Project, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and others. But some of the solutions being put forward are not solutions at all and continue to threaten forests. And we know that without forest protection, our environment will continue to be degraded and our planet will be at risk. This includes protection of people and cultures who have long lived in and with the forest. Today, we focus on the impact of the wood pellet industry and forests and our health. And I would like to welcome our guest, Adam Collette, who is the program director of Dogwood Alliance, which mobilizes diverse voices to protect U.S. southern forests and communities from industrial logging. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Sojourner. Happy to be here.
Okay, Adam, what we're going to do is we're going to play a clip we actually got from Dogwood Alliance website called Slow Burn, the world's largest wood pellet maker.
The idea that we are shifting power in our forests that are huge carbon sinks to wood pellets, to something that emits so much greenhouse gases, has been hugely problematic. And I will confess, there is a sustainable way to use wood pellets, and that would be exclusively from byproducts. So we're talking leftover bits from sawmills, and that is the antithesis of what's actually going on in North Carolina.
We have to use the commercially available solutions to climate change that we have today, right? And we have to hit them all. That includes wind, that includes solar, right? That includes geothermal, right? Certainly batteries. And that is that does include bioenergy, right? All together are needed to have any chance to keep it at, to keep climate change at 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius.
All righty. So our guest, Adam Collette, Program Director of Dogwood Alliance, he has a passion for organizing people and fighting the corporations whose practices destroy our earth. While attending the University of North Carolina, Asheville, where he graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Management and Policy, he began his career in activism as an intern for Dogwood Alliance. Since then, Adam has worked with several organizations to fight coal plants, protect our public water systems, and build the sharing economy. In his spare time, he loves spending time on and in the rivers of Western North Carolina. So, Adam, we are happy to have you, and I envy you the time you spend on and in rivers, I'll have to say. So
yeah,
healing.
Yeah, well, it is very healing, and we live in a beautiful place here in the U.S. South and have some of the most amazing southern forests, which is why I'm so passionate about protecting them.
Right. Well, start out by telling us a bit about the Dogwood Alliance.
Yeah, so Dogwood Alliance was founded in 1996 with a mission, as was stated earlier, to protect the forests and communities living in the southern U.S. We have worked since that time to really transform some of the world's largest paper companies who own and operate land and log here in the southern U.S. And the southern U.S. is actually one of the world's largest wood baskets. We produce almost more wood products than anywhere else in the world and have some of the highest logging rates.
Wow.
Yet at the same time, the amount of protected land or even public land is very small. And so it requires mobilization of communities, of influencing policy members, of working with landowners, and pressuring companies to change their practices on the ground. And we've been doing that for over 20 years, and our current focus is on both the bioenergy industry and influencing the role of forests within these bigger climate policies.
Right. Before we get into that, though, tell us about the interrelationship of forest protection and basically saving the environment, including just doing something about this warming of the planet.
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because protecting forests and keeping our intact forest ecosystem standing is one of the best solutions that we have to solve the climate emergency. One of the facts that I often give people is that if we need to get off fossil fuels. Most everybody knows that and has heard that. But what I remind people of is that if we get off fossil fuels tomorrow, which should happen, that only gets us halfway to that fabled 1.5 degree mark that was set forth in the Paris Climate Agreement. The other half of the solution is actually removing carbon from the atmosphere. And the best technology, the best natural technology that we have to do that is our forests. And not only do our forests remove carbon from the atmosphere, but they help protect our vulnerable communities who are living on the front lines of climate change from flooding, from loss of biodiversity. They purify water, and they provide so many benefits to our human and natural communities that they are absolutely a vital part of the solution to addressing this climate crisis.
Right. And Adam, I remember just years ago, many years ago, in the back in the day, as we would say, being at a meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where a number of us activists and campaigners of color came together to discuss the whole issue of environmental racism. We know that, of course, impact of the environment impacts everybody. And we're seeing that increasingly, especially with the flooding that has impacted farmers in huge swaths of the United States and more. But a lot of people, though, still, look at protecting forests and the environmental movement as something that, well, is kind of like a white thing, you know what I mean? And not really of concern to people of color. But that is so far from reality, because the frontline communities are, for the most part, indigenous communities and communities of color. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I would say, and I very much appreciate you bringing it up, because this is the heart of the issue, and really, as we see it, this interconnection between vulnerable communities on the ground who are dealing with these impacts, and the extractive economies that are the major contributors to climate change that oppress them through their practices. And in addition to the impacts that these communities face, I would also raise up the historical context here of land and our forests as a representation of home, and the way that for centuries and generations that land, and from our indigenous communities who were the first peoples here in this country, to black farmers and landowners who worked the land, who have systematically had that land removed from them and taken over by these global industrial extractive economies. And in the U.S. South, we often think about oil and gas and coal as the natural resources of extractive economies, and those certainly in the Gulf South and in the Southern Appalachians are huge impacts. But along the coastal plain, which is where we work and Dogwood Alliance focuses, so I'm talking coastal Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, many historically people of color communities, the major extractive industry there is timber. And these are also, in addition, some of the poorest communities in our country, and they're some of the most vulnerable to climate change. So this issue around industrial extraction of our forests is both deeply rooted in the historical ties of systematic racism and oppression, and the current effort to address this climate emergency and where the impacts are being felt. So there's a lot wrapped up in this, but at its heart is we need to be keeping our forests standing, and we need to be listening and empowering the people who are on the front lines, who are dealing with these impacts, to be coming up with real solutions that benefit them.
Right, and the beautiful forests and trees that help us to breathe. Just yesterday I was having a conversation with, we have a small staff here, our show is out of Southern California, KPFK, and then rebroadcast on a number of stations around the country and worldwide on SoundCloud, but we have a really tight, small staff. And there are three of us who are Black on the staff, who in our adult years were diagnosed with asthma. I mean, the fight to breathe, it seems, you know, we're having this issue of the fight to breathe everywhere. So, and we know that that is, all of that is connected to the environment and the forests and the trees that really, in so many ways, make our breathing possible. But tell us, you know, so because there's some terms I know that are used, like biomass, that people may not generally know. When you talk about, let's say, a biomass landscape or biomass, what are you talking about? And what does this have to do with the threat, particularly of southern forests in the United States?
Yeah. So when we say biomass, what we mean is natural material. So biomass is a very broad term. It could mean anything from the algae that you have maybe heard be used for energy, or forests. And so it's a very broad term. But generally speaking, any industrial use of biomass is coming from forests and is wood. So what has happened is that there is a European effort that was promoting renewable energy.
Yeah.
And they wanted to increase their share of renewable energy, and this happened around 2009. Well, around that time when they're wanting to increase renewable energy, they decided that biomass and burning wood essentially was carbon neutral, so they weren't going to count any of the carbon coming out of the smokestack, and it was a legitimate form of renewable energy. What that led to was many major utilities and power stations beginning to replace the coal that they were burning with forests and with wood.
Yeah.
And where were they going to get that wood? They were going to get that wood from the southern United States. So literally, we have created a market where forests, mature natural forests in the southern U.S. are being clear-cut,
wow,
turned into these things called wood pellets, which basically looks like rabbit food, and it's meant to be put on these ships. They get manufactured. It gets put on a ship. It's sent across the ocean to a place like Denmark or the Netherlands or the U.K., and it's then sent to be burned in power stations. And all of this is being subsidized as renewable energy. And it is a fascinating, terrible, destructive industry that has developed from well-intentioned policies that haven't paid attention to the true value of forests and have continued to succumb to a commodification of nature. And so what you have here is an extremely destructive industry that is developed over the past couple of years.
Yeah, and put forward as a solution, right? And, you know,
exactly.
To me, it really is a massacre of trees. That's really what's going on. We could look at it that way. And just quickly also, I mean, there are people like corporations like Drax and Viva, is that it?
Yep.
Who are playing such a critical role in this. And I'm glad you underscored the connection with Europe, because we're certainly going to let our friends and colleagues and our listeners in Europe know about what's going on, because I'm sure that they'll be very concerned about this as well. So you all, I know, have been up against trying to do something about these corporations. So just tell us briefly about that. And also, if people, for people who want to support your efforts to protect the forests that in the area you're working on, what they should do.
Yeah. So we have been working, we launched our campaign in 2013, and it's called the Our Forests Aren't Fuel campaign. And we have been working both at the international level and at the local level to stop the growth of this industry and to protect forests and to promote true renewable energy such as wind and solar. And we have, since that time, we have built an incredible movement across the South who is in opposition to this industry.
Wow.
When these facilities are proposed, we've seen an attempted massive expansion by this industry. And every single facility, at least here in North Carolina where we're based, is placed in an environmental justice community, just to make a quick connection to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
But we are beginning to see incredible momentum and opposition grow to this industry. We have organizations from across the country who have denounced biomass. We have communities who are rising up in opposition. We've had several facilities that have either been delayed or stopped in their tracks from being built. And in addition to that, we've just had the governor and state of North Carolina denounce bioenergy as a part of their clean energy pathway.
Great.
We've had Virginia denounce bioenergy and biomass as a part of their 100% renewable commitment. And we have several policies moving through the state of Georgia. So we're really beginning to see these states recognize the impacts from all of the media and the community organizing that we've been doing. And we feel confident that in the next couple of years, this message will be very much heard in Europe, and we'll be able to further limit the industry on top of what we already have done.
Right. So you're making some good strides there, and we were so excited to hear about the Green New Deal in Europe putting forward a care income as well, that kind of fusion approach, protecting, you know, dealing with poverty as well as protecting the environment is so
yeah.
vital. How can people get information about Dogwood Alliance and about the work you're doing?
Yeah, so I would suggest that if folks go on to dogwoodalliance.org is our website. I would highly suggest that you go to the Act Now page. We have a general pledge that people can sign, which is the Stand for Forest pledge. You can take action right there on the page and sign the Stand for Forest pledge, which is just a basic petition saying you stand up for forests. And that way we can keep you updated on what we do. We're also very active on all of the social media channels. And so please, you know, search us at Dogwood Alliance. And also just give us a shout. If you're ever in the U.S. South, feel free to reach out to us and ask us questions. All of our information is on the website there. So we'd love for people to get involved in those ways.
Right. Well, we would love to do that. And Adam Collette, we are out of time now, but we really want to thank you for your commitment and work, the entire Dogwood Alliance, for protecting our planet, really, and all of us. And we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project, with whom we partner for our weekly Earth Minute and Earth Watch series. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking with you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron is continuing to chip away at workers' rights and what is left of the welfare state in France. In response, since late last year, France has witnessed massive strikes against a planned reform of the pension system put forward by French President Macron. The strikes now in their 36th day were initiated by the General Confederation of Labor, or CGT. Macron is proposing to merge France's pension schemes into one state-managed system, but as the CGT and other unions, as well as just generally, it seems like so many sectors of France have been out on the streets opposing this. What they point out is that Macron's proposal will mean millions of workers will end up working beyond the legal retirement age of 62, which is what it is now in France, or receiving a far lower pension. Let us go to a clip now from CNN. This was a clip around the time the strikes began late last year.
The largest nationwide strike in decades is playing out on the streets of France as protesters aim to cripple the country over pension reform. Railway workers, teachers, emergency room medics, all striking today over President Emmanuel Macron's plan to overhaul the retirement system. 90% of trains and 20% of flights are cancelled today, and some unions predict the country will be paralysed until Christmas. Well, we're following the strikes from Paris on the ground with CNN's Jim Bitterman, who is live at the Champs-Élysées, and our Melissa Bell, who joins us from Gare du Nord train station. Let's start, though, with our Jim Bitterman. Jim, just tell us, we're seeing some pictures here coming in today of the protest. Tell us what you've been seeing this morning, and just explain why Macron's push for this universal retirement system has been so controversial.
No problem, Christina. First, the Champs-Élysées is pretty quiet right now, but in order to keep it that way, the French have mobilized 6,000 police and gendarmes across the country, units like this one right here behind me. And all around the Champs-Élysées, there are units just like this deployed everywhere and all around the country, because more than 200 demonstrations have been planned across the country. There have already been some confrontations, and you've probably got the video. There were confrontations in Lyon and Nantes and other places where police have had to use tear gas in some cases against the demonstrators. They're guarding against here on the Champs-Élysées against the idea that these radical demonstrators on the fringe of the demonstrations, we've seen it in the past, come through and just bust things up, do a lot of damage. The cause of all this, the cause of the nationwide strike, is the government's attempt to reform the pension plans, and especially the special pension plans. There's something like 42 different pension plans in France, and one of them is sort of a general pension plan, and 41 others are special regimes, as they're called. Basically, they're special rules that apply to different categories of workers that are deemed particularly difficult, like subway drivers and train drivers and whatnot. And so while normal French people can retire at about age 62, for some of the train drivers, for example, they can retire at 52. In any case, the government wants to harmonize all those plans and come up with one general kind of fix for the pension system. And of course, the people who are losing advantages, they're basically against it all.
All righty, a CNN clip. And on Monday, January 6th, a crucial week of negotiations between trade unions and Macron's government officials started amid nationwide protests and transport strikes against the planned restructuring. And during a recent cabinet meeting held on Monday, Macron suggested that the government is not inflexible. This reported by Al Jazeera, leading some to claim that there is room for negotiation, but that remains to be seen. Nevertheless, numerous unions have organized nationwide protests on today, that's Thursday, January 9th, and also on Saturday, January 11th, with the CGT union also calling for workers to disrupt the country's oil refineries and depots. Meanwhile, in Southern California, on Thursday, January 9th, today, the Teamsters Local 848, they are holding a protest outside the Consulate General of France in Los Angeles in a show of solidarity with striking transportation workers in France who are members of the trade union CGT. And the Teamsters union members, they're also planning on protesting at the Embassy of France in Washington, D.C. That's today, Thursday, January 9th. So here to update us on all of this, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Benoit Martin, who is jointly based in France and the U.K., who writes about and monitors grassroots movements in France, including the recent strikes, as well as the Yellow Vest movement. And Benoit works with, is a member of Payday, a network of men working with the global women's strike. Benoit, welcome back.
Thank you, Margaret. Nice to be with you today.
Okay. Did we get our lead up to talking with you right? Was there anything?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
That's great. Yes, yes.
Right. Tell us about the impact, though, because I don't think people here have a sense of the strength and breadth and numbers of these protests that have been going on across France.
This has been since the 5th of December 2019, when the movement started. This has been the longest protest movement in France since 1968.
Wow.
For which France is famous for. The core protest has been really led by the transport worker in the train and the subways and buses and so on. During December, it was very, very hard to circulate in France. One train out of four only was working. All the rest was not. So a lot of people could not go to work. A lot of students couldn't go to school and so on. So there was really quite a paralysis of the activity. There are obviously other sectors of workers who have taken action and strikes. For example, teachers have been striking one day here, one day there. We heard that the lawyers have taken a week of strike starting last Monday. Today is a big day of demonstration and strike, so today should be quite important. It's the second general day of protest. There was one on the 17th of December, following the start of the strike on the 5th. At that point, there was up to 2 million people who were involved in striking or protesting, marches. It's literally every little places in France has been affected by that movement. So that's quite extraordinary. And people say today is a test, so to see how the movement can hold on to its strength against the government, who really hasn't shown so much opening. There's been, as you mentioned, some of these negotiations. Some grassroots people say, look, these negotiations are not going to bring much more. They're calling on trade union leaders not to go to these negotiations and rather spend their time organizing the strike and broadening the strike. Obviously, not all workers are in a position to strike. The transport worker, a lot of them have been doing that for 36 days. It's very costly. Obviously, they don't have their wages. There's a bit of money if they're collecting money to pay them a little something to sustain themselves and their families during that time. But some smaller enterprise or some places in the private sector are not in a position to do that. So they're calling on the big organization, the trade union, to put their resources really behind the battle and their money and really call for the strike to be unlimited for everybody or as much as possible. So that's a bit of the situation. So what we'll see today would be quite interesting in terms of see if we could go even beyond what was achieved on the 17th of December, and that would be telling about the pursuit of the movement.
Right, and there have been a number of arrests, and it's reported that on Wednesday, January 8th, the chief of police of France resigned after 2 years on the job, saying, quote, he felt washed out after more than a year of anti-austerity protests. So put this also in the context of the Yellow Vest, what's known here as the Yellow Vest movement. I mean, has there been a connection? Because I've seen, like, the major things like the Eiffel Tower was shut down. I saw a photo of ballerinas, of artists actually out on the street with their tutus on participating in this protest. So, I mean, that's pretty widespread. But has there been any support coming from that Yellow Vest movement that was so vibrant last year now with these protests?
Yes, to a point. I don't think the connection is totally made, if you know what I mean. But there's been, we can see here and there, some Yellow Vests supporting the movement. To be fair, the movement is really a wage worker, not just unionized, but if you have a wage, you will be more likely to be affected by this pension reform.
Right.
Obviously, the Gilets Jaunes are a sector of workers who are less unionized, less wage. They're often self-employed, very low income, but still. But they're trying to connect with them, supporting them. I saw example of some agricultural yellow vests who were bringing food to some strikers and that kind of thing. But there's more to be done, really. I think, on the other hand, the Gilets Jaunes the yellow vests have been protesting every Saturday because that was their day off where they could do that. That has continued, not at the same level, but nevertheless, every Saturday you could read about it and you could see that they are protesting in many cities still.
Right. Those protests of the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests, is still going on. And just an interesting side note, not so side, is the fact of the Teamsters here in the United States getting in the act. And for our listeners who are in Southern California, from 9 to 10 this morning, the Teamsters Local 848, they're going to be outside the Consulate General of France in Los Angeles. So I suppose anybody who wants to be part of that or show up in solidarity can do that. And they're also saying that they're seeing their own retirement attacked. In particular, there's a company called Airgas, which is owned, a French-owned corporation, Air Liquide. They're fighting against pension cuts as well. So we're seeing this kind of international support. I don't know if there have been reports of other international reports in other parts of the country. Benoit, just today is a big day. Saturday is going to be a big day. So mm-hmm. I suppose it all remains to be seen what's going to happen with it, and also what's going to happen with this interrelationship between the unwage sector, which is represented so much by the Yellow Vest movement, and these wage workers, because we know very well that when wage workers go out on strike, a lot of times it's their family members who are unwage that are really helping mm-hmm. also to make that survival and support for the strike successful. So just some mm-hmm. final thoughts from you, Benoit.
Well, we're hoping that the movement will grow. The reform has not been voted as a law yet, so it's not finished. They're talking about the 24th of January where government will vote on that sort of thing. So between now and then, I think the movement hopefully will grow. It's also becoming, I think, a point of reference for... it's fantastic what's happening with the Teamster, really. And we're making sure that movement is being publicized in the UK, where I'm based at the moment, because this is really a very a test. Macron is really a key person who's trying to implement privatization, austerity, and so on. And if he can be defeated, that would really encourage others to take, the protest against poverty. And also the whole battle, as you mentioned in your previous segment, about climate change. This is really an economic struggle. We really need to put the money on climate change initiative and not, to the rich, which is happening at the moment.
Right. An interesting note, just finally, Benoit. When we look at our SoundCloud, we're heard worldwide on SoundCloud. And when we looked at our statistics from SoundCloud last week, the city with the highest listeners of Sojourner Truth was Paris, France, if you would believe that. Is that amazing? So something is going on over there. And Benoit, we will check back with you to continue to get updates on this important movement. Thank you so very much, Benoit. Martin.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a station break, and when we return, we'll be digging deep into Iran. There's so much focus now on the strikes, on the assassination ordered by Donald Trump of General Soleimani, and a lot of people really don't know a whole heck of a lot about the history, the deep and old history and culture of Iran. And Dr. Azul Rad is waiting to discuss that with us. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Join us now.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, we have, at 9 o'clock, we have Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 10, it's KBOO's Radio Zine. It's Sprouts, a program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers featuring radio production of national interest. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11. They discuss the worst of 2019, from bad TV shows to intellectually bankrupt large screen offerings. Then at 11, it's Digital Divide. Now back to more Sojourner Truth.
We're going to strike for you by the Peace Poets. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook at our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud, and today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Southgate, California, and internationally we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Israel. Yes, we do have listeners in Israel. And we are now going to turn our attention to history and culture of Iran. Before welcoming our guests, though, let's hear Defense Secretary Pompeo defending or trying to defend Trump's earlier threat, which he then walked back a bit, to attack Iran's cultural sites.
President Trump has been resolute. We will continue to be. We will defend America. The strikes we took over this past week, including killing the terrorist Soleimani, we will continue to take if we need to. If we need to defend American interests, we will do so. What President Trump said last night is consistent with what we have said all along. Iranian proxy forces in Iraq have thought that they could act with impunity, and that if they acted, we wouldn't take strikes against Iran proper. We've made clear 4 months to the Iranian regime that that wouldn't be the case, that we were going to hold responsible the actors, the leaders who took these actions and who orchestrated these actions. President Trump's tweet last night made clear we will continue to do that, and the American people should know we will always defend them, and we'll do so in a way that is consistent with the international rule of law and the American Constitution. We've done it before. We will do it again.
Well, you're saying two different things there, sir, with all due respect, because President Trump's threat on Iranian cultural centers centers of interest to the Iranian culture would not be in accordance with international law. So which is it?
Jake, they're not two different things. I've been with President Trump through the entire strategic planning process related to our entire campaign, diplomatic, economic, and military. We've built out an enormous coalition to push back against the Islamic Republic of Iran and its kleptocratic regime. The American people should know that we will not waver. We will be bold in protecting American interests, and we'll do so in a way that's consistent with the rule of law. We've always done that, Jake, and President Trump's tweet doesn't deviate from that one iota.
So cultural centers are theoretically fair targets in your view?
Jake, we're going to do the things that are right and the things that are consistent with American law. I've been part of the discussion and planning process. Everything I've seen about how we will respond with great force and great vigor if the Iranian leadership makes a bad decision. We hope that they won't, but when they do, America will respond.
Well, that was CNN and rightfully Jake Tapper doing some pushback in Defense Secretary Pompeo on the threat to cultural sites from Iran, very, very ancient civilization. And I'd like to welcome our guests to discuss just the history and culture of this ancient civilization. I'd like to welcome Dr. Azil Rad, who graduated with a PhD in Middle Eastern history from the University of California, Irvine. Her PhD research focused on modern Iran with an emphasis on national identity formation and identity in post-revolutionary Iran. With this background, Dr. Azil Rad works with the policy team on research and writing related to Iran policy issues and the U.S.-Iran relations. Azal joined the National Iranian American Council as a research fellow in January of 2019. And before that, she worked as a volunteer in election and voting campaigns in 2018. And she joined the team in order to further this work and embolden the voices of Iranian Americans. In this role, Azal Council works to organize Iranian Americans around issues that affect the community. Dr. Azalrad, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so people, you know, it's in the news, the attacks, the back and forth, the scuttling of the nuclear deal, etc. But it's really shocking how many people know so little about Iran, and the White House actually threatening to bomb these cultural sites perhaps reflected some of that lack of knowledge. Don't want you to comment on that in particular, but just give us some sense of the deep history of this country.
Well, you know, I'd like to first note, as you noted, my area of expertise is actually in modern and contemporary Iran. But
I think you're cutting in and out now. Just repeat what you just said. It's modern and contemporary Iran, that which is fine, because that will give us some sense of the recent history. But it is also a very ancient civilization, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's what I was saying. As someone who is of Iranian heritage and has traveled extensively to the country, you know, I've visited many of the sort of sites that are important from antiquity, such as Persepolis, which is ruins from the Persian Empire, which is about 2,500 years old. You know, so the way that Iranian contemporary national identity sees itself is as a history, as a continuous people from 2,500 years ago. Now, that's the notion of a nation state, and you could argue about the notion of this continuous identity, but this is how national identity was formed in Iran, and it goes back to this land, which has been home to a civilization rooted in the same sort of culture that you see today from more than 2,500 years ago.
Right, and with a population today of 82.5 million, we're told a huge land area over 636,000 square miles, the language Persian or Farsi, and the official religion, Shiite. And we know, of course, that means that Iran also has several enemies in the region as well as in the West. But, you know, looking then in the area of your expertise, and I just want to mention also that I was reading a story, I think, about the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. I think it was the grandson who went into a battle and was defeated. They were all killed. And that there is this story of a major imam who will reemerge, and some people think it will be the reincarnation, so to speak, if I got that right, of the Prophet's grandson, and that this has a lot to, you know, this plays a role too in the identity and nationalism of people in Iran, where even I read I think it was a relative of the deposed Shah came out in opposition to the U.S. assassination of Soleimani on the grounds of that kind of love for country and nationalism. Dr. Azalrad.
Mm-hmm. So the story that you're referring to is Imam Hussein, who is really what is seen as the quintessential martyr within Shiite Islam. Now, when you're looking at Iran, the Shiaism is certainly an important aspect of the cultural identity that you see today, but Iranians weren't Shiite until about 500 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at this very long history, there are many religions that actually emerged from this particular piece of land. For instance, Zoroastrianism, which was tied to the Sasanian Empire, and this is, you know, 1800 years ago that we're talking about. But those threads are still very much part of Iranian culture and contemporary culture. So for instance, the celebration of Nowruz, which is the spring, when spring begins, the spring equinox, that those types of celebrations are tied to pre-Islamic culture. And that is one of the, that is called the most widely celebrated festival or holiday that exists in Iran and within the Iranian community. And it's not just the Iranian nation state that celebrates Nowruz. Because of this sort of ancient culture, it's something that's celebrated by Zoroastrians, by Persians, by people that are throughout the region. So there's more to that culture than just the Shiite thread, but that is of course there as well. And I think what we're often missing in the conversation about Iran is, it's either one side or the other. Often,
yeah.
Some people want to portray it as, no, Islam is something that was brought here and it has nothing to do with this identity, or that no, we are Muslims and those things are things from the past. And really, if you look at the way that these threads are manifested in Iran's popular culture and just dealing with Iranians on a daily basis, like any other place, like any other groups of people, your culture is a very complex thing and it has many, many strands to it. American culture is a perfect example. Because America is a country of immigrants, it has so many threads, so many different aspects to it. So it's very hard to just say, this is what American culture is.
Right. Well, you tell that to some people who seem hell-bent on making America white again, as those of us of African descent here think. Not that this country started out white in the first place, but you're absolutely right about that. And when you look at a country like Iran, you talk about the ancient pre-Islamic Iran or Persia going back 4,000 BC. You know what I mean? There's a lot of history there. If you look at the history of the United States, I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket in contrast to that. But just in terms of the foreign influence, I should say, or foreign destabilization that has happened, including more recently in Iran, because the United States, they were involved in overthrowing a democratic head of Iran, and then a lot happened after that. Tell us a bit about that, and also, the role of oil. I mean, if you look at what the interests of the United States, Britain, and other Western powers, just even very early on, oil was part of the calculation.
Yes, absolutely. So Iran was never formally colonized the way that many other countries in the region were.
That's right.
But it was still within, but it still existed within this context of 20th century colonialism that, that to your point, oil was the driving factor. That's why so many countries like Britain, like the United States, were attracted to the region, is because of this very important energy source. And to this day, we're still very dependent on that source of energy, right? As we see conflict arising, there's immediately people start talking about things like gas prices, the price of oil, how it's going to go up. So that's a factor in the sort of politics that we've seen over the last 100 years. In the case of the overthrow you're talking about, the coup d'etat of 1953, the reason why the coup of 53 is so important in understanding sort of this context of contemporary U.S.-Iran relations is very often from the U.S. perspective, we always think of 1979 and the U.S. embassy seizure, right?
Yeah.
When we think of Iran, part of the origin of that enmity comes from images of, Americans held hostage. So what's interesting about that is when you look at the Iranian perspective, it goes back further. It goes back to 1953 and the idea that they had a prime minister who had popular support and was overthrown in a coup with the U.S. and Britain, and installed the former Shah, who was by all means seen as a dictator and, really buckled down on any political dissent to his rule. So that memory for Iranians is also important. And really, as for me, as an Iranian-American, as someone born in the United States who is, of Iranian heritage, it's less about pointing fingers and more about mutual acknowledgement for mutual grievances that are both rightful, and trying to find a path forward where we, sort of shed this old baggage and can have not necessarily even... with baggage and can have not necessarily even some kind of, we don't have to be allies, we don't have to be friends, but we don't have to be in constant conflict, which is what we've seen under this administration. Starkly different than what we saw under the Obama administration, who never said that, you know, Iran is now the United States ally, but simply said, even with your adversaries, you could have dialogue and we could move past this sort of aggressive rhetoric that we constantly see between these two sides.
Yeah.
Baggage and can have not necessarily even some kind of, we don't have to be allies, we don't have to be friends, but we don't have to be in constant conflict, which is what we've seen under this administration, which is starkly different than what we saw under the Obama administration. Baggage and can have not necessarily even some kind of, we don't have to be allies, we don't have to be friends, but we don't have to be in constant conflict, which is what we've seen under this administration, which is starkly different than what we saw under the Obama administration, who never said that, you know, Iran is now the United States ally, but simply said, even with your adversaries, you could have dialogue and we could move past this sort of aggressive rhetoric that we constantly see between these two sides.
Yeah, and I mean, about oil and that 53 coup that you mentioned, I mean, that prime minister who was overthrown, he wanted to audit documents of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which was a British corporation, which is now part of British Petroleum, and to limit the company's control over Iranian oil reserves. So I'm sure that had something to do with his overthrow. And looking at today's market, we see Iran holding 10% of the world's proven oil reserves, 15% of its gas, OPEC's second largest exporter and the world's fourth largest oil producer, and also controlling access of the Strait of Hormuz, where over 20% of the world's oil passes through. So that, you know, has a lot to do with it. But finally, I hope we can have you back and get a bit more into this. I'm just looking at the clock here. But, you know, we hear a lot about the Shia and Sunni conflict and split, you know, about the role of Saudi Arabia. You know, we hear a lot of complaint, some of which may have a rightful base in the United States, about the unhappiness of some of the population in Iran with the present government. And we hear very, very little about the repression, on the other hand, that happens of people in Saudi Arabia, you know, including women, for example. So there definitely seems to be a bit of a double standard. And then a lot of people also not getting the relationship between Iran and Iraq, because when we look at Iraq, we see up to 66% Shia in Iraq, as opposed to up to 36% Sunni. So it's a lot to kind of grab hold of, but I just wondered if you could give us a little context here and some final thoughts.
So a couple of things. The, you know, Shiites and Sunnis have existed from the beginning of Islam, and the idea of sectarian differences, much, this is why we talked about colonialism earlier, in when this region became colonized, trying to exacerbate such sectarian differences is something that, you know, divide and conquer is a very sort of classic term within colonialism. And so these groups of people are not separate groups of people. They're all Muslims. They, you know, they're of different ethnic stripes. Both Shiites are different ethnicities and Sunnis. I mean, there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, so this is a huge population that we're talking about. It's incredibly diverse. And so this sort of clean split that people try to depict as if it's, you know, Shiites on one side and Sunnis on the other is incredibly misleading, right? If we talked about Protestants and Catholics still in those terms, like, this is just the split, Protestants and Catholics don't like each other, it's misleading to say it that way, because of course that's not the case, and of course they all come under Christendom. So I wanted to, you know, emphasize that a lot of these sectarian differences are actually more based on political divides that
right.
then, you know, play on this discourse rather than the actual divides. They live together. You don't have to have the exact same interpretation of a religion. That doesn't mean that you're going to be bound by some kind of clash forever. On the comment about, you know, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, of course, both states repress their populations. Both, neither state is democratic or free. And so those are, and but they are quite different. You know, they're also not really comparable. Iran has a democratic apparatus, I should say, within the state, right? So they have a parliament, they have president, they have elections. But of course, the issue is that it's overlaid by this larger system that is unelected, an unelected body that's the supreme leadership. And this is the problem in Iran. Saudi is a completely different situation. There's no, you know, president, there are no elections of that kind. They're incredibly different states. But the hypocrisy that we point out is problematic because it really plays to, you know, what is the purpose of U.S. policy? If we're going to say that our concern is about democratic principles or human rights, then we have to be consistent across the board. And in reality, we are not consistent across the board.
Right.
There's really no question to our inconsistency. And that plays to the fact that it has little to do with those things, but they're very nice sound bites. It's good to say, you know, we're against this government because they are terrorists, but we have no problem with this other government, even though they have very similarly problematic kinds of, you know, things that happen.
Right.
For instance, Dr.
Axelrod, we are going to have to leave it there, but please come back so we could continue this conversation. We're just out of time, sadly.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a terrific discussion. And I'd like to thank all of today's guests on today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our audio engineer, assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives, 1-800-735-0230. Go online to Pacifica Radio Archives.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, it's Rising Up with Sonali.
The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center wouldn't exist without the local folks who volunteer their time to help the homeless. In episode 4 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast, we meet Tiana, Pete, and John to learn what they do, why they volunteer, and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland.